Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for a bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. With me today is my regular co-host, Cleveland area attorney and Republican factotum, Jay Carson.
Hey.
How are you doing today, Jay?
I'm doing good.
Well, you know, we have a whole bunch of questions and comments from listeners, and so let's just plunge right in if you're ready.
All right, I'm ready. Fire away.
Well, first we have Dusty, who asks, have we reached a turning point in qualified immunity with the recent ruling in Brooklyn? Or if not, how do we retreat in our system from potential abuses? So, Jay, I thought this would be a good question for you to take the lead on since you are our attorney. I do have some thoughts on it, but I guess maybe it would be good if you started by maybe explaining to listeners what qualified immunity is.
Yeah, well, the idea with qualified immunity is that public officials and law enforcement officials have the right to be wrong, and they won't be held sort of criminally or civilly liable for wrongs that are committed when they essentially have a good faith basis to do so. They're acting within the scope of their duty. It grows out of the government, the idea that you can't and ought not to sue the government. And that was sort of whittled away and changed over the years. And now you can, of course, you know, sue the government where the government has waived its sovereign immunity. But it still is sort of jealous in guarding that sovereign immunity when it comes to law enforcement officers for a lot of smart policy reasons. I don't know that particular ruling changes where we see qualified immunity going, because it's always necessarily on sort of a case by case basis, and what's reasonable. Yeah, go ahead.
I should point out the couple fascinating things about the ruling. The ruling was issued by a federal judge in Brooklyn who is, and I kid you not, 96 years old. He's been on the bench since 1967, so for 51 years now.
You'd think if he was going to get upset about it, you would have said something
before now. Which is just amazing to me that we have a 96-year-old federal judge. My understanding is that in his ruling, his age aside, he basically said that essentially the rulings in the past, the recent rulings, I guess, in the past, according to him, well, for him, anything in the last 30, 40 years would be recent, right? But I couldn't help. But anyway, have gotten things to the point where essentially he says all but the plainly incompetent are protected. And he thinks that the court has gone too far with qualified immunity. And certainly anyone would say that there has to be some sort of a line. I guess I'm wondering from a legal standpoint, do you think he has a point? Do you think the court has gone too far? Because no one would say that.
Again, to say the court, I think that's a difficult thing, because a lot of these decisions are made not at the federal level, but at the state level. State court systems utilizing various qualified immunity statutes that happen to exist in that state. And again, looking at the specific facts of the case. I can tell you one, this is all right. I mean, it's not a funny story, but it's a little bit of a funny story. I spent a summer working in the Ohio Attorney General's office. And there was one case that, we would, you know, often see these sort of cases, because the Attorney General, steps in to defend, local governments, state governments, when they're sued. And the qualified immunity question dealt with, there was a fugitive, from the police who was running, they're chasing him. He breaks into a house to hide out. The people were not home at the time, but the police surround the place, SWAT team, everybody come out with your hands up. No, he won't. So then it's sort of like the end of Christmas Vacation, if you've ever seen that. The police start firing tear gas into the house, break down the door. Sort of completely demolish the place. And at which point the homeowners pull in and say, hey, what's going on here? And the police say, hey, look, just doing our job. And in that case, there was, I believe, qualified immunity found, that, look, these were the police. They're acting, reasonably to try to apprehend, this fugitive. And therefore, the torts that they may commit in doing this, they're immune from. Now, I should say to our listeners, there's something that's different between qualified immunity, which is for negligent acts or whatever bad acts by the police, as opposed to like a 1983 intentional violation of constitutional rights. So, for example, the police just pull someone and violate their constitutional rights, beat the hell out of them, something like that. That's a different sort of analysis than the typical statutory qualified immunity. This is more, there's a police chase and the police car hits you while they're involved in the chase.
Right. So, in this case, that I believe it was, there were four cops who assaulted this guy after he didn't let them into his apartment because they didn't have a warrant or something like that. And they said, well, we're just, doing our job and so forth. But he didn't find against these police officers. He just refused to dismiss the suit under qualified immunity grounds. So it remains to be seen whether or not, it'll be found that these officers did anything that, would merit some
correct.
Sort of
thing. My understanding was there would be a couple different claims in that sort of suit. There would be the, again, just the negligence doing your job. But there was also likely an intentional constitutional violation claim.
Right.
Which is something a little different.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's see here. Tyler emailed us and he writes, while I do agree that we have to keep regulators' power in check, so this is starting out very well for you, Jay. Doesn't the same logic apply to the companies being regulated? Uh-huh. Aren't they also trying to expand their power and influence and need to be kept in check? Some of the companies are bringing in more money than most nation states. Sometimes I worry we're moving toward a snow crash libertarian corporatocracy. Ooh, I like that last bit. That's a little nod to Neal Stephenson, who's an amazing author. I love his stuff. Tyler, I really like that reference. So, Jay, I guess this is a question really for you. It started out kind of promising, but then it kind of went in a non-libertarian direction for you. So what do you think? Is that just Tyler a point?
No, he's got a point. And it's not to say that, that we ought to reflexively oppose all regulation. I think one of the most important regulatory steps that our country took back in the early part of the 20th century was antitrust laws. The idea being that companies can't become too powerful, can't control everything. The idea in a robust capitalist system is that various companies, various competitors provide an effective check on one another. But they have to actually be competing against each other and not acting in concert. And that's what the antitrust laws are, designed to protect. I think the idea that we need to, and the philosophy, and this comes down in a lot of antitrust cases, is the courts always say, look, the point of the Sherman Act isn't to protect competitors, it's to protect competition.
Right.
So I think those types of regulations, protecting a robust competitive system, are absolutely appropriate. Can they go too far? Absolutely. I mean, I think you can look at what the Trump Justice Administration, who just got slapped down a week or so ago, did, talking about this AT&T merger, which was a vertical rather than horizontal merger, I could go into all that, but the court basically said, and again, antitrust is sort of a weird area where the courts are kind of given more leeway for lack of a better word, policymaking, in that they get to sort of make sort of a lot of determinations on, well, hey, is this good for the market? Is this bad for the market? But that aside, look, I don't think anyone would propose, except like the most, hardcore libertarians, I don't even know if Trey's in this camp, would say that there ought to be no regulation, no FDA, no OSHA, any of those sort of things, basic protections. But I think it becomes a matter of degree. And as I pointed out before, the impulse for any regulator is always to expand power. and bring in more more regulation. And more often than not, that regulation seems to work against competition. It works in favor of the market in raising the costs to enter the market or raising compliance costs on smaller competitors.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that at all. I think in many cases, the best form of regulation is actually just to ensure free and full competition where there's no collusion between the companies and that sort of thing. That can be difficult at times.
No collusion.
Yeah, that's important. Yeah, I just realized that. Yeah. But you know, that can be tough at times. And there are some industries where it's just not really possible for there to be that kind of free and full competition. And that's when government has to step in a little bit more. And reasonable people can disagree about where that is. But other things being equal, which they never are, but other things being equal, if I'm offered a choice philosophically between writing regulations or first allowing competition to try to take care of taking care of customers and ensuring they're not getting ripped off and so forth, I'll go with the competition every time.
Amen.
So there you go. All right.
And you know, and again, I think we also, especially in this day and age of instant access through the internet and you know, Yelp reviews and Angie's List and stuff like that, there's a lot more transparency and businesses tend to pay much more of a price than they might have years ago if they do something perceived as anti-consumer or even just, you know, give, you know, provide bad service. That reaction is a lot quicker than what it used to be. So
in some businesses that is absolutely the case. In other businesses where there are a lot more problems of transparency or of information, good information, like for instance healthcare or some would say education, that can be a lot trickier to do for sure. All right. Moving on, let's see here. Next is Andrew, who wonders, how do journalists and the media in general react, or how can they, I guess, react in a way that balances the power of the executive branch with Trump's disconnect between what he says and what the executive branch does? So I guess if I'm interpreting, you tell me if this is your interpretation, Jay, but kind of how does the media provide, well, fair and balanced coverage of the executive branch, and on one hand, being sort of respectful that this is the elected president of the United States and the choice of almost the majority of the people. But on the other hand, when the leader of the executive branch, the president, is, you know, clearly lying about a lot of things a lot of the time. And that's my take on it. Did you read that differently? I don't know.
Well, sort of. I guess my thought was that it seems in some cases, the executive branch is you know, Donald Trump is the head of the executive branch, but he is not necessarily the executive branch himself.
Sure.
You know, so there are a lot of other things that happen you know, Donald Trump may or may not control that arise out of the, you know, either way. And typically it's so funny the way that the media usually portrays this is, you know, they'll say something like the White House has issued a statement saying that right. This or that. I mean, that's sort of the more like the executive branch as opposed to Donald Trump tweeted X, Y, and Z. And you know, the one you get the sense that it is more something that is coming through John Kelly or other sort of just the White House staff or you know, an agency working in tandem with the White House staff, you know, the way the executive branch has typically operated versus the Trump government by Twitter. You know, I know because this is what the question is getting to, is a lot of times you come up you know, completely different, you know, here the White House is the executive branch is doing one thing and Trump is saying another, or is reversing course from what he was saying was going to be the official policy yesterday. And I don't know, you know, how you, if there's a better way to cover that than what they do right now. And I suppose the best way is to, you know, name sources when you can, and let people evaluate who's doing what. Yeah. So,
and a lot of the times the source
does that
is
make
Donald.
Sense?
Yeah, a lot of the time I think the source that you name is Donald Trump from just, you know, a few days or
sure.
sometimes even a few hours ago. And, you know, there really was a big debate in a lot of the media.
I mean, I guess sort of the idea is I mean, I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's the question of kind of is what the president says necessarily the executive branch policy?
Well, by definition, if the president says it, that supersedes anyone else in the executive branch. So, you know, well, I mean, by definition, you know, but, you know, but like I said, there was a big debate about this. And I know the New York Times, the Washington Post certainly were very reluctant at first to say the president has been, they generally don't use the actual word lying. They'll say he said this, then he said something else. And they still don't really use the word lie, but they became more likely to say, well, the president is misstating this, or the president said this and this is untrue, that kind. So they don't like to use that word lie, but
right.
they've become more comfortable with saying that. And I think it's simply because this is a very different president, regardless of what you feel about his policies. He does just come out and say things that are untrue on Twitter, mostly on a basis on to an extent that we've never seen before in the modern era. And they had to figure out a way to deal with that. Most previous presidents, they wouldn't say things that were flat out untrue. They would find a way to shade the truth. But Donald Trump doesn't worry about shading the truth. He'll just say false things.
Yeah. Or, I mean, there are a lot of statements that are, you know, things that are typically presidential statements of opinion, and it can't necessarily be verifiably true. I mean, if you want to say the economy is doing great, well, okay. I mean, that's, I don't know that you'd say that's a lie. If you say, job growth is up at, you know, 57%.
Sure.
Well, no, it's not. that's a measurable objective sort of thing that someone can fact check.
Or for a more recent example, when you say there's nothing I can do about illegal immigration, then a day later you pass an executive order doing something about it. You know, that's
right.
Well, that's just.
Well, and so again, I'm wondering, I don't know if that's a it's sort of the George Costanza thing is, Jerry, it's only a lie if, you know, it's not a lie if you believe it.
Either way, it's pretty concerning. It's either being mendacious or being incompetent. You know,
well, I mean maybe someone whispered in his ear like, "Oh, yes, you can, sir." Well, oh, all right.
there's
those sort of things that, and
go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean. Okay.
I'm out of stuff. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know
there you go. We'll move on. All right. Move on to Noel, who asks, could you talk about popular perception of migrants coming here for a better life and how this affects our interpretation of the facts? This recently was driven home to me as one of the main sticking points in this conversation. If you fundamentally mistrust people's motives for coming over, it becomes easier to justify certain types of policies. For me, the issue is humanized because I have too many friends who are here because their parents crossed the border and I know them to be good people. I feel addressing this perception issue might be key. For example, I feel totally different about arresting gang members crossing over as part of organized crime because I see their motivations as immoral. So if people are seeing families' reasons for coming across for a better life as immoral, then it might be harder to truly empathize with their situation. This became clear to me when a friend of mine referred to such people as opportunists and to their actions of bringing their children as forcibly smuggling them. All right, Jay, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I guess I'm saddened to hear that your friend, that people would say that, the opportunists and the smug, and because I think I relayed this on one of these shows. We don't always share all of our private lives, but I spent back in my college years, a couple summers working, teaching English as a second language to immigrants. My experience was, these were incredible people. They were incredibly, brave, smart, dedicated, hardworking. Really, this is what America, to me was all about. These are people who are coming here with absolutely nothing and they're working hard to create a better life for themselves and their families. In the process, they're typically creating a better life for the rest of our country on a bunch of different levels. So I get that, and that's how I view. I'd say the vast majority of the people who want to come here, they want to come here for good reasons. They want to come here because of the freedoms we enjoy, because of the economic opportunities we enjoy here. So that being said, I can still say, look, I think you people may come here with the best of motives, but we still need to have a border that we control and enforce. Sure. And that's just a matter of national sovereignty. Countries decide who comes in and how they come in. I've argued before that, you know, maybe what we need to do is a bigger liberalization to allow more legal immigrants in. I mean, we're in a situation now where we actually have more jobs than we have people who are willing to fill them. So I think that's, you know, that's my response. But it's not to say that, you know, but by the same token, I guess when you look at it, if someone is crossing into the country illegally, from a very legal standpoint, their motivations don't matter. Right? I mean, you may have a really good reason for speeding. You know, you might be trying to get to your kid's baseball game on time after work, and you get pulled over, and hey, that's a really good reason. Or you might be speeding to your next drug deal. Regardless,
sure,
you're speeding, and you're going to get stopped. And there's a certain interest that every citizen has in seeing that laws are enforced.
That's an interesting example, because I would think in one situation, the cop might write you a ticket. Now, you obviously wouldn't be dumb enough to say, well, I really need to make this drug deal.
Yeah.
But in another instance, you might very well not get a ticket based on, well, prosecutorial, I guess you could say, discretion. We talked about that before. So I think that does matter, you know, and I've said before, while, you know, people crossing the border illegally are by definition committing a crime, we need to take into account their circumstances. And in many cases, these are people, and I would say from my understanding, the vast majority of cases, these are decent people who are fleeing horrific violence and grinding poverty, looking for a better life in America. And that should factor in.
Well, I would say it factors in, but let's also look at the way we have this set up for the people who are seeking to escape violence. There is the asylum process. Now, it's not great because we don't have enough judges. There's a huge caseload backlog. It is sort of a broken system.
I should point out that the Attorney General recently said that asylum won't apply for those kind of things. That it's only for basically people who are personally being politically persecuted and fleeing violence is not grounds for asylum. And that's something I just disagree with. But anyway,
I think you can talk whether you're talking generally fleeing violence or particularly fleeing violence.
But I think to Noel's question on this, there are people like you, but I think there are a lot more people who have never had any sort of encounter with someone who's been here legally or otherwise, not any kind of real human encounter. And they do dehumanize them. They see them as these people, not like us, who are coming over. But the truth of the matter is, in almost all of the ways that truly do matter, what they want for themselves and their children, they are exactly like us. And I think, to Noel's point, that the more we understand that, the more people we can get to see these people as humans who have the same drives, concerns, cares, anxieties as people who've been in this country for hundreds of years do, the more we can work together for a truly humane immigration policy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, I don't know that there's anything you can say to the folks who are going to be anti-immigration because I don't want someone different. I don't want that's a strain that has sort of surfaced and it sort of pops up and then sort of goes back to the bottom. And there was I don't know if I said this before. When I, John Meacham, historian, author, spoke at the conference I was at a couple weeks ago, and that was sort of the theme of his speech, is if you look at America and you think things are terrible and there's this big anti-immigrant bias now, that's not necessarily the case, and it's sort of cyclical. And that the way to combat it is to sort of depend on our better natures, that these things pop up and then our humanity sort of reasserts itself. And again, my big issue is always that legal immigration versus illegal immigration, and I think there are a lot of conservatives who see a very big bright line there. Just on this is what the law is, and if you want to follow the process, you have to follow the process.
Yeah, and you know, I think that some of those conservatives might have their attitudes changed if they heard from somebody and they were able to sit across the table from them and say, listen, why did you do this illegal thing? Why didn't you come in? And if they would hear some of those responses, I think it's possible that their view might change. And that's, you know, I think that's a fundamental problem with a lot of things. There's a group called Better Angels, which kind of was formed based on this idea that for so many Americans, not all of them, there are some people who are just so set in their ways, they don't care, you can't talk to them. But most Americans aren't like that. That if you get people across the table from each other, talking to each other as people, that it's amazing how much understanding, if you create the right kind of environment, you can actually arrive at. But of course, so much of our discourse isn't that anymore. It's this kind of fragmented, echo chambery sort of thing. And, you know, the Fox News, MSNBC kind of thing that is just so incredibly toxic to any kind of discourse, rational, not just rational discourse, but humane discourse, whether it's immigration or anything else, really.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, let's close out and talk about what we're reading this week. So Jay, what do you have for us? What are you checking out this week?
Oh gosh. You know, I had one that I sort of used on the after show, but I'll float that again. There was a great piece by David French in National Review, talking about Chris Pratt's acceptance speech at the MTV Movie Awards. And if you're a conservative like me, you typically tune out any sort of movie award type speech because it's usually the same sort of, celebrity kind of prattle. But Chris Pratt gave a really funny, clever, heartwarming sort of speech to the, you know, very young audience, basically rattling off sort of his nine rules for life and success. And some of them were just clever and funny, but a lot of them really hit on sort of a deeper spirituality that you don't typically see coming out of Hollywood. So I thought David French's discussion of it and the actual speech by Chris Pratt, who I'm a big fan of from Parks and Rec and also the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. It's just really good. And it lifted my spirits, I guess, a little bit.
Certainly always use a little bit of that.
So there was that. And then the other piece, which is, I would say, a very darker thing that I was reading, but I referenced this, was Jay Winnick's op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about folks who are comparing the migrant crisis and the separation of families to the Holocaust and to Auschwitz. And he delivers a very sharp punch in the face to those kind of folks. And if you read this, it is, I mean, his basically what he says is, as a historian, here's what happened in the Holocaust. And he spells it out in fairly graphic detail, what happened to those families, and says, again, any comparison to what's going on in this country right now is off base and is truly offensive to what went before and to honoring that memory. It really sort of cheapens that a little bit to use that argument to for something that we've got going on here. And I had something else, but now I've lost it. But so those are two sort of short pieces, but I think sort of hit different sides of the human condition, if you will. So. Right.
Yeah, I think as a general rule, it's safe to say that whenever anyone in political discourse mentions Holocaust or Nazis or Hitler, and it's not in reference to ethnic cleansing or something like that, it's safe to say that they are making too much of a stretch. They're going too far to make some sort of rhetorical point.
And I would say it's even worse to say. I mean, a lot of people, there's always the, you know, anytime there is a sort of populist figure who, you know, whatever, gets a crowd going, there's the, well, this is how Hitler got started. Which, fair enough.
Sure, it's true.
Hitler made a lot of, you know, but lots of politicians make, you know, populist rabble-rousing speeches, and they're not Hitler. It's even something else, though, to compare a policy that's going on, which you can certainly debate the wisdom or the morality of it, and compare that to mass extermination.
Yeah, I think you need to ask what your goals are. I mean, there can be things that are true, but unnecessarily inflammatory. And if your goal is to get people on your side worked up and to preach to the choir, maybe that's what you want to do. But most people, I think they would say, no, my goal is for a better, saner, more humane country and world. Then maybe when you're making those references, you need to stop, take a step back, and really think about what you're going to be accomplishing with that kind of language.
Yep.
So, all right, well, what I'm reading, or I guess I'm going to talk about what I'm watching, I suppose. As some listeners might know, but most probably don't, every summer, my wife goes away somewhere international, takes a big international trip for about a month, and I stay home with our four dogs. Now, because she and I have very different tastes in TV, this gives me an opportunity to binge watch all the things I've been saving up all year. I mean, it's horrible when she's gone. I feel like basically a part of my right arm has been cut off or something. It's awful and horrible. It's the worst. It's the worst month of my life every single year, but I'm so glad she gets to do this. But the one saving grace, I guess, in a way, the one little silver lining is that I get to just gorge myself on all these shows. And so the shows I am watching this summer break, because I'm right at the halfway point. I still have a couple weeks until she gets back. Animal Kingdom. I don't know if you're familiar with that one, Jay.
No.
It's kind of like
it's not like the Marlon Perkins kind of.
No. It's got sort of a Sons of Anarchy sort of vibe to it. It stars Ellen Barkin, who was big in the 80s and so forth. It's kind of fun. It's kind of fun, just mindless sort of thing. Bosch, which I really like. That's on Amazon. I'm Westworld. I'm just getting into season two. Last year when she was gone, I finished season one. There's this show that Amazon does every year. They follow a season of an NFL team, kind of like HBO's Hard Knocks, I guess, which I haven't seen. This year, they're following the Cowboys last year. And so since the Cowboys didn't do too well last year, I'm enjoying that because it's a Steelers fan.
I was going to say, how could you watch that?
Well, whenever the Cowboys do poorly, it's like a little victory, I think, for goodness in the world. And yeah, anyway, but there's a comedy on Amazon about the 1980s called Red Oaks. And that's pretty much, those are all the things I'm binging.
You're kind of goofing off then.
Well, you know, basically what I do is after dinner, that's kind of like my TV time. I'll read a book for a little bit out in the porch, usually until the bugs get too bad. And so I've been reading, I just finished up a history of the Jesuit order, which was fascinating stuff. I'm reading a book now by a Jesuit theologian called, the guy's name is Teilhard de Chardin. He also is a scientist and geologist and so forth. It's some really cool stuff, I think. So I'm kind of on a little bit of a Jesuit kick. But after I do that kind of theological heavy lifting stuff, I go and I watch
Jesuit kick every now and again.
Yeah, you know, I mean, kind of. Well, the Jesuits are really kind of like the Marine Corps of the Catholic Church in a way. And so, as a Marine, I'm very much drawn to the Jesuits. And as you might remember, Jay, I actually went to a Jesuit high school in Cleveland for a couple of years before the phrase they used is "Ask me not to return." So, but there you go. So that's what I've been doing.
Mitching
and all that stuff. And so that does it for this week's show. Thanks, everyone. We hope you do like what you We think, well, I can speak. Wow. We hope you like what you heard. Yeah, it's been a long morning. So I also wanted to mention, thanks everyone who's been subscribing to my new podcast, the interview show Politics Plus. I really do appreciate that. And also, you know, if you haven't subscribed or listened to it, there's some great guests, David Frum. I'm having the right-wing columnist Mona Charon come on the show to talk about her new book about feminism. She's sort of in favor, but not in favor of modern feminism. Anyway, I'm learning a lot. We got some great guests lined up. Again, it's politicsplus.us, or you can find it wherever you find your podcast, just like Politics Guys. All right. So if you want to get in touch with us, you know how to do it. mail@politicsguys.com. There's our Facebook page, facebook.com/politicsguyspage. And we are also on Twitter @politicsguys. The executive producers of the Politics Guys are Michael Baranowski, Jay Carson, Trey Orndorff, and Bruce Johnson. Today's show is produced by Michael Baranowski. We'll be back with a new show on Saturday. We hope you'll join us.